Heck, Shiner would have been Chip's best man if he could have stood at the end of that aisle and held those rings. But we compromised and set him up under a gorgeous oak tree so he could be comfortable in the shade as he watched his old man get married. My dad and I arrived at the ceremony by horse-drawn carriage. A trumpeter played us in. We had a little string quartet and a beautiful couple who sang during the ceremony. All of our closest friends were there. It was a day we'll never forget.
I still look back at that as one of the best days of my life. A lot of my friends and her friends met for the first time at our wedding because we were literally from different universes. But they were all so important to us. And I just remembered that all my buddies were like, she has got the sweetest friends. All these people kind of came together and became buddies. You know, it was great. There were all these funny coincidences too. Joe had twins in her wedding party. I had twins in mine. I mean, what are the chances of that?
Chip's dad was his best man. My sisters were my maid and matron of honor. The fact that our friends got along so well and that we both put family first were just more signs to me that Chip and I weren't all that different where it counted. There were a lot of similarities between us, and that day seemed to be filled with affirmations of just how much we truly belonged together. The wedding seemed to have a ripple effect, too. My sister, Mary Kay, brought this guy to the wedding that she'd only been on a few dates with. His name was David. Well, she caught the bouquet, he caught the garter, and they wound up getting married, too. How's that for a story? Chip and I started our honeymoon off in New York City, where I had done my internship. One of my favorite things to do when I lived alone in New York was just to walk the streets. There are fascinating landmarks around every corner, people of every culture and background and style you could ever imagine, and so many interesting shops and restaurants. No matter how many times you walk those streets, you would always, always find something new. One of the most surprising finds to me were the little individual shops and boutiques, whether they were clothing stores or home furnishing stores or gift shops. It was almost as if the owners of those little individual shops had to work extra hard to make sure their businesses could compete with the big chains and expensive stores all over town, and the results were incredible. There always seemed to be a candle burning, filling those shops with the delicious scents. It wasn't unusual to see fresh flowers on the counter next to the register or for the shopkeeper to offer you a cup of coffee or tea while you browsed. There was something just wonderfully inviting and warm about those places that made me feel very connected in a city that could sometimes feel big and overwhelming. I loved taking Chip to that great big city and showing him a side of me he hadn't seen before. We acted like rich kids and stayed in a suite at the Drake Hotel, a high-end first-class place on Park Avenue that had once played host to celebrities like Frank Sinatra and Lillian Gish. But that was just the starting point for our adventure. We set aside a full 2 weeks for our honeymoon, and other than those couple nights at the Drake, we made no plans whatsoever. We decided to rent a little car and just go wherever the day took us. We headed upstate and marveled as the massive city gave way so quickly to hills and rivers and fields full of flowers. Before long, the tallest buildings around were the silos on old-fashioned farms that dotted the landscape. Chip and I both had an affection for farms and old barns and silos, and we decided it would be fun to go explore. If we saw an abandoned barn, all gray and weathered and tipping over in some empty field, we'd stop and go walk around in it, even duck inside just to see what was there. Occasionally, we find old bottles and farm equipment, and I always wondered why someone had just up and abandoned them for all those years. The thing I found interesting was just how beautiful everything looked. The rust, the age, the weathering. Maybe it was just because we were in love, but everything we saw in those old abandoned barns, both inside and out, seemed to capture and reflect the beauty of the land and the air and the early summer scents in that beautiful corner of the world. Even the dust in those old barns seemed to rise up on purpose, helping to illuminate those old forgotten spaces with streams of sunlight that crept through the cracks in the wood. We didn't have Google Maps in 2003, so we spent that honeymoon road trip following our intuition and heeding the attraction of little signs on the side of the road, antiques, or bed and breakfast, or pick your own. We agreed that we would drive until we were both dead tired and then find some place to lay our heads wherever we happened to wind up. On the first night, we ran into this place called the Mohonk Mountain House. We'd been driving along the cliffs of the Hudson River, and then all of a sudden, this hotel made of stone rose up in front of our eyes. It looked just like some sort of medieval castle.
It was late, and we were both exhausted from all this exploring. We both thought maybe we died or something. Is this place for real, or did we just drive off that cliff to get here? It was weird just to cruise into this driveway and have no idea what to expect and then find a place like this.
We wandered into the lobby, half expecting it to be our final resting place. The good news is we weren't dead, and when we told the nice people at the front desk that we were on our honeymoon, they put us up in a gorgeous penthouse suite for the price of a regular room.
People wound up giving us deals like that almost everywhere we went on this trip. It was incredible, and thank goodness, because we were really low on funds.
From there, we decided to continue up into New England, meandering across the Berkshires and western Massachusetts, cutting through the country roads of southern New Hampshire, and heading north to explore as much of the crashing Atlantic on the rocky main coast as we could. We stayed off the interstates and took back roads as much as possible, stopping at antique stores and mom-and-pop shops and cute old barns and farmhouses, whatever caught our eye. One night we stayed in the dreamiest bed and breakfast right on a farm, where we ate fresh eggs and a home-cooked meal in the morning. Both of us agreed, what could be better than that? Before I met Chip, I was basically a city girl, or maybe a suburban girl. As a kid, I lived in a typical cookie-cutter neighborhood in Wichita, Kansas. We lived there until I was 12, while my dad kind of worked his way up the corporate ladder for Firestone. But as a small child, I would often go visit my friend's farm. She had silos that we would play in. I thought that was the coolest thing. My friend hated living out on that farm. She wanted to come play at my house so she could be in the neighborhood, riding bikes with all my friends. But I liked going to her house because it was a farm. We would pretend we were these farm girls that wore aprons, and we'd come up with stories like, hey, let's pretend that Bobby got stuck in the silo. We played so much make-believe at that farm that I feel as though farm living was a part of my past, even though it really wasn't. Driving through the beautiful farmlands along the back roads of New York brought back the memories of my time spent there.
Grass is always greener, right? We were both brought up in these sort of cookie-cutter neighborhoods, but in my case, I loved going to my granddad's ranch. That was definitely where I got the cowboy in my personality. My granddad, JB, was a bona fide cowboy. He was like the Marlboro Man, literally smoked cigarettes, tall, lean, great-looking dude. Always had this gorgeous cowboy hat on, wore long-sleeved shirts and long pants every day of his life, even if it was 100 degrees outside. He was just one of those iconic characters. I still, to this day, think of him as a hero of all heroes, the legend of all legends. I don't mean to overstate that, because my dad was a huge hero to me, too. He was the one who was there. He was the one who loved us. He was at every ball game. My granddad wasn't really the doting, overly loving kind of guy, but he was kind of the patriarch of the family, and spending time with him on that ranch made a big impact on my life. I may have grown up in the suburbs like most kids did, but I've always felt like JB and I had a lot in common, and I've always felt like I was born 100 years too late.
For either of us to romanticize farm life was probably a silly thing to do. It's a lot of work. For my friend, living on a farm just meant she had a whole lot of chores to do, but no matter how much I heard her complain, I still thought, that's what I want someday. So having that little taste of farm life on our honeymoon sure felt right to both of us. Days later, somewhere along the woodsy coast of Maine, at around 11 o'clock at night, we had another memorable moment. We were tooling around a corner when Chip slammed on the brakes, squealing to a dead stop. He and I both stared out through the windshield and said, "What in the world is that?"
Luckily, we weren't in a hurry and we weren't driving too fast, because right in front of us there was this big, awkward-looking moose right in the middle of the road. Neither one of us had ever seen one in person, and we just could not believe how big this thing was. It was like a dream come true for me to come across that kind of an animal in the wild. Once I realized what it was, I was like, whoa, what should we do? I feel like we should do something. Joe said, let the poor thing go. So of course we did. We watched that majestic beast just wander off into the woods and disappear into the darkness just as fast as he'd shown up in our headlights.
I feel like the moose was our final big find of that trip. We were both tired, and after seeing something that magnificent, we decided it was time to head home. We took a different route down through Boston and realized as we drove through the city that we were basically out of money. We had nothing left. We stayed on the interstates after that and made it back to New York with as few stops as possible, arriving just in time to fly back home.
Joe's idea of being broke was when she had like $1,000 left in her bank account. I wasn't much for bank accounts. I didn't use credit cards back then. So once we got back to Waco, we literally had no money left for a hotel room or anything. We had no choice but to go straight to the vacated rental house we were both planning to move into. The students had just moved out of it while we were on our honeymoon, and it was nighttime when we got back home, so we didn't really have a chance to get in and inspect it or get it cleaned up or anything like that. We just drove in from the airport and pulled up in front of that dreamy little yellow house on 3rd Street, and at the end of this amazing honeymoon of a lifetime, wah, wah, wah.
And Chip carried me over the threshold, right into a nightmare. 4. The honeymoon's over. The rental houses on 3rd Street that Chip owned when we got married were really small and not the most attractive homes. I wouldn't have chosen to live in any one of them if I could avoid it. Thankfully, though, the nicest one of the bunch happened to open up at the end of the spring semester, and Chip hadn't put any summer renters into it yet. It was a yellow ranch style with a nice white porch on the front and a pair of huge magnolia trees in the yard, and it was bigger than the rest, maybe 1,200 square feet or so. It was just pretty enough that I was excited to live there and fix it up, to make it feel like our very own home. Chip and I were both exhausted when we finally pulled up in front of that house, but we were still riding the glow of our honeymoon, and I was so excited as he carried me over the threshold, until the smell nearly knocked us over. "Oh, my word," I said, pinching my nose and trying to hold my breath so I wouldn't gag. "What is that?" Chip flicked the light switch, and the light didn't come on. He flicked it up and down a few times, then felt his way forward in the darkness and tried another switch. "The electricity's off," he said. "The girls must have had it shut off when they moved out." "Didn't you transfer it back into your name?" I asked. "I guess not. I'm sorry, babe," Chip said. "Chip, what is that smell?" It was the middle of June in Waco, Texas. The temperature had been up over 100 degrees for days on end, and the humidity was stifling, amplifying whatever that rotten smell was coming from the kitchen. Chip always carries a knife and a flashlight, and it sure came in handy that night. Chip made his way back there and found that the fridge still had a bunch of food left in it, including a bunch of ground beef that had just sat there rotting since whenever the electricity went out.
The food was literally just smoldering in this 100-degree house. So we went from living in this swanky hotel room off Park Avenue in New York City to this disgusting, humid stink of a place that felt more like the site of a crime scene than a home at this point. Honestly, I hadn't thought it through very well, but it was late and we were tired, and I just focused on making the most out of this awful situation. So we opened some windows and brought our bags in. I told Joe we'd just tough it out, sleep on the floor, clean this place up in the morning, and that's when she started to cry.
I lay down on the floor thinking, is this what my life is going to look like now that I'm married to Chip? Is this my new normal? That's when another smell hit me. It was in the carpet. "Chip, did these girls have a dog here?" I asked. They had a couple of dogs," he answered. "Why?" You could smell it. In the carpet, it was nasty. I was just lying there with my head next to some old dog urine stain that had been heated by the Texas summer heat.
Microwave dog pee.
It was. It was awful. It was 3 a.m, and I finally said, "Chip, I'm not sleeping in this house."
We were broke. We couldn't go to a hotel. There was no way we were going to knock on my parents' door at this time of night.
That's when I got an idea. We happened to have Chip's parents' old RV parked in a vacant lot a few blocks down. We had some of our things in there and had been using it basically as storage until we moved in. "Let's get in the RV, we'll go find somewhere to plug it in, and we'll have AC," I said. As we stepped outside, the skies opened up. It started pouring rain. When we finally got into the RV, soaking wet, we pulled down the road a ways, and Chip said, "I know where we can go." It was raining so hard we could barely see through the windshield, and all of a sudden, Chip turned the RV into a cemetery. "Why are you pulling into a cemetery?" I asked him. "We're not going to the cemetery," Chip said. "It's just next to a cemetery. There's an RV park back there." "Are you kidding me? Could this get any worse?" "Oh, quit it, Joe. You're going to love it once I get this AC fired up." Chip decided to go flying through the median between the two rows of RV parking, not realizing it was set up like a culvert for drainage and rain runoff. That RV bounced so hard that had it not been for our seatbelts, we would have both been catapulted through the roof of that vehicle. "What was that?" "I don't know," Chip said.
I tried to put it in reverse, and then forward, and then reverse again, and the thing literally wouldn't move. I hopped out to take a look, and I could not believe it. There was this movie a few years ago. The main character gets in this RV, and he gets caught in this fulcrum, and it's sitting there teetering on both sides of the wheels, just spinning in the air. Well, we sort of did the exact opposite. We went across that valley, and because the RV was so long, the butt end of it was stuck on the little hill behind us, and the front end was stuck on the little hill in front of us, and the wheels were just sort of hanging there in thin air. I crawled back into the RV, soaking wet, and gave Joe the bad news.
We had no place to go, no place to plug in so we could run the AC. It was pouring rain, so we couldn't really walk anywhere to get help. And at that point, I was just done. We wound up toughing it out and spending the first night after our honeymoon in a hot, old RV packed full of our belongings, suspended between two bumps in the road.
The next morning, someone from the RV park spotted us and was kind enough to call a tow truck. The first truck they sent wasn't big enough, so they had to call in a semi-tow truck. One of the big ones. We were freaking out, and of course, we were completely broke. Are you starting to pick up on the theme here? We stayed flat broke a lot of the time early on. We didn't know how we were going to pay this guy. But then our very last little honeymooner's miracle came through. That truck driver said, "Well, guys, looks like the honeymoon's over. This one's on us."
This was just the way things were with Chip. He was always going out on a limb, but God always had a way of looking out for him. Actually, God seemed to always be out on the limb with him, taking care of him. We should have been more careful not to spend every last dollar on our honeymoon, but that favor from that sweet man made us feel as if maybe some things were just meant to be. By the light of day, we went back to the yellow house full of hot stink, and I made up my mind right then and there to make the best of it. I pulled myself together and rolled up my sleeves, as people say, and I said to Chip, "Okay, let's do this." What else could I do? This was our home now. We didn't have any other options. I covered my nose and mouth and started cleaning. Once the two of us got the worst of it out, Chip went off and took care of some business. There were rent checks in from his other houses that needed to be cashed, and as soon as we had a few dollars in hand, we hit the hardware store. I had never done anything design-related at that point, but there was something very liberating about starting from scratch. We knew every room needed to be painted, all the carpet needed to come out, and all the hardwood floors needed to be refinished. And Chip gave me free rein to make that home whatever I wanted to make it. To be honest, I didn't know what I wanted to make it, so I started with one basic idea. I have, like, 6 favorite colors, so I'm going to paint every room one of those colors. Once I got going, I decided that using different colors in every room wasn't enough for me. I wanted to make every room a different theme. I went with a nautical theme in the front room and decorated with a bunch of cheap sailboats and netting that I bought at a hobby store. The kitchen was French-inspired, so it was mustard yellow. Our bedroom was hotel-inspired, so all white. The back room was Chip-inspired, so it was cedar and horns and cowhides. Every room was completely different. We did every part of this renovation together with our bare hands. Chip restored all of the hardwood floors, all the tile work, everything. I was learning as we went, but I definitely did my part.
That house was gorgeous. Joe did an awesome job helping fix it up, and her ideas were great. There was a moment in the kitchen when I smarted off, though. I don't even remember what I said, to be honest, but Joe got real mad and started yelling. She was carrying this 5-gallon bucket of primer. She slammed it down on the ground to make a point, and it splashed right back up in her face. It was dripping off her eyelashes, her nose. Whenever something like that happened in my family, we'd all just laugh, you know, so I laughed. Even though she was mad at me, and that made her even angrier, she started yelling again, and the primer dripped all over. And at that moment, when I looked at her, and everything just seemed to go in slow motion, I thought, I love this woman. She is tough. I think this is going to work.
That was our real first fight, and even now we both agree it was our biggest. Chip had smarted off about something, so my blood was already boiling. But when I slammed that bucket down, Chip says I became a ninja, the kind you don't want to mess with. Yet he still laughed against his better judgment. We joke about it now, like, well, I'm mad, but I'm not primer in the face mad. It would take us a few months to get everything in livable condition in that house, even though we were living there full time. Looking back, I don't know how we did it, but I guess you have a lot more time and energy before there are kids in the picture. We were newlyweds. We had our whole lives ahead of us. And despite the rough start, we were still riding the excitement of our honeymoon and feeding off of that energy we seemed to have whenever we were together, which was basically all the time. Chip never said no to any of my ideas. He was 100% on board for my various theme rooms. He spoiled me in that way. But it was more than that. Chip supported everything I wanted to do. He even supported my dreams. The two of us would dream together all the time, just lying in bed at night, imagining where we could go in life, talking about things we always wanted to do or see or accomplish. Until I left home and went to do my internship in New York City, I honestly didn't know what I wanted to do. At some point in my teen years, I told my father that I wanted to take over his Firestone shop when he retired. I thought that was the right thing to do. I thought it would make him proud, as if I were the son he'd never had who would step into his shoes and carry on the successful business he'd created. Then I went to Baylor and got interested in broadcast journalism. I loved the storytelling and the editing process, and I managed to get 2 years' worth of internships under my belt at our local CBS station, KWTX. Everyone said that if you wanted to make it in TV news, you had to go to New York City to do it. So I went out on a limb and applied to The Today Show, Good Morning America, and 48 Hours. Those shows didn't have internship affiliations with Baylor at the time, so it was a long shot to say the least. I just went in and did it on my own out of blind, naive ambition, I guess. I had lived a pretty sheltered life up until then, so when 48 Hours selected me, I was worried my parents might fight it. How could they let their little girl go to the big city all by herself? But I was wrong. My protective parents not only supported my ambition, they paid for my apartment for the 6 months. A good thing, too, because it was $1,500 a month for a room in a shared apartment with two other people. As amazing as it was to live on West 57th Street and to work under a man as esteemed as Dan Rather, I quickly fell out of love with the news business while working that job. My job as an intern was to read the papers to find salacious stories, cold cases, or horrible crime stories to pitch to the senior editors. It was heavy. While I fell out of love with TV news, I did fall in love with New York City. It was more than just wandering in and out of those lovely boutiques that I mentioned before. I was pretty homesick during those 6 months, and I especially missed my mother. So it was eye-opening and beautiful to see so many people in that big city who looked like my mom and me. It seemed that everywhere I looked, there was a woman walking down the street who reminded me of her. It was so unlike growing up in Kansas and Texas. New York is where I finally began to appreciate all the different cultures and truly began to fall in love with my Korean heritage. It's difficult to put into words, but there was something about that experience that helped me find myself. I would go home every night and write about my experiences, what I'd seen, what I'd done, and sometimes just about whatever I was thinking or feeling. And as I did that, something shifted in me. I started owning who I am, realizing that I was unique and that God had a unique purpose for me. I spent my whole life worrying about what people thought about me, or whether I was good enough, or thinking about what I should be doing instead of really digging down to find what I really wanted to do. I'd always been a religious person. I was brought up in the church, and my parents were very committed to getting the family there every Sunday without fail. So from the age of 5 to about 20, religion to me was a matter of, you do this, and you don't do that, and you do your best to walk the straight line. I was good at that. I'm good at following the rules, most of the time. But once I was on my own in New York, my faith became something very personal. It was no longer about what my parents knew or what my pastor knew. I came to think of God as more of a gracious friend who was accompanying me on this journey, a friend who wanted to carry my burdens and speak into my life and shape me into who I really was and who I would become. When I got back to Waco, I had a very different perspective. I went back to work at my father's Firestone shop knowing that I didn't want to do broadcast journalism, but also doubting whether or not I wanted to take over the tire business. I spent a good part of my days in that back office daydreaming and sketching ideas out on a yellow steno pad. I wasn't sure I wanted to run my dad's business, but I definitely liked the idea of owning my own business. I thought about what kind of businesses I'd like to own, a spa, a bakery, or a home store. Whatever I chose, I wanted it to be as beautiful and welcoming as those boutiques in New York. I drew pictures of what the shops might look like. I designed logos. I never shared those ideas with anybody, and there were times when I thought I was just being foolish. In fact, I started thinking about my degree and the fact that I'd worked at one of the top evening news programs in all of television, and I wondered if maybe I'd given up on TV news too soon. I wondered if maybe I should go back to New York and go for it. I was actually in the middle of pulling up all the old contacts I'd made during my internship on the very day I met Chip at the tire shop. And so I stayed in Waco, and my life took a sharp turn down a path I could have never imagined. We'd only been living in the yellow house for about a month when I flipped open that yellow pad and showed Chip some of my ideas. Remodeling and redecorating that house had filled me with all sorts of new inspiration, so I showed him the sketches and plans I had made for a little home decor shop. I told him I wanted to apply everything I'd learned from this house and my days wandering around Manhattan to a business idea I'd been playing around with. "Someday," I said. "Why not right now?" Chip replied. "What do you mean?" you go drive around and find a building you like, and let's do it. We'll fix it up just like we're fixing up this house, and you can open your business right now. Are you serious? Of course I'm serious. Go find a building and let's do it. Why not? Chip had this way of turning far-off dreams into something that seemed real and achievable in an instant. He filled me up with a confidence I'd never known. He made me believe I could actually do it. So I did. I drove around Waco with new eyes, searching around every corner and strip mall for something that I could turn into my vision. One day, I spotted this building on Bosque Boulevard. It was sunburnt orange, a bit like Chip on our first date, and it was all boarded up, but it looked more like a little house than a cookie-cutter strip mall type of business. It backed up to a residential neighborhood, it had its own little parking lot, and it was right next door to a church. There was something cute and quirky about that place that just caught my eye. It wasn't for sale. It basically looked abandoned, but I took a picture on my phone and sent it to Chip. I love this building, I told him. His response was, Joe, that thing is ugly. But I love all the windows, and I can imagine these pretty displays.
I picked up some dumps, some buildings that weren't pretty either. But this place seemed like it was on the wrong side of town for a retail location. It looked more like a place that you'd turn into a little gas station or a used car lot or something like that.
Chip didn't feel good about it, but he did some research anyway and found out the property was owned by a woman named Maybelle, who was probably in her 70s at the time. We reached out to her, and she agreed to meet us at the building. She told us the whole history of the place. Her son had been renovating it for years, but he had gotten very sick and had never been able to finish. She'd received a couple of offers on the property, but she just wasn't ready to part with it yet, especially since those bidders wanted to turn it into a used car lot or something else she didn't want to see in the neighborhood. She and her son had been looking to open up a tuxedo shop, and she was hoping for something along those lines. We had a good talk with Maybelle, and she loved the idea that I'd be opening a shop I would run myself, that I had no interest in tearing down that little building her son had worked on for so long. Before we left, we told her we'd like to make an offer too, and she said that when the time came, she'd rather sell it to us than the other folks. So we got all excited. Thinking back, maybe we got excited a little too quickly, because we'd never thought through exactly how we'd finance the place.
I had a line of credit that worked really well for flipping houses. It was a short-term thing. But I didn't really have the credit needed for this long-term commercial purchase like this. Even though this was going to be Joe's business, it really made sense to both of us that it be in both of our names.
I had a tiny bit of savings tucked away that I decided I could use for a down payment. I'd never thought I would touch that money, but Chip inspired me to do something more with it than just to let it sit in the bank earning next to nothing in interest. I also knew that if I filled out a loan application, I'd still be able to show the income I'd been making at my dad's shop. I might even be able to qualify for some kind of small business loan available to women. We decided to go for it, and were excited to hear about some financing options Chip hadn't used before.
The bottom line is that I loved Joe, and she loved me, and we really loved working together. Working together energized us. It just worked out best. And no matter what it took, I was going to make this little shop work for her. When she shared that little yellow notepad of sketches with me, I knew this was like Joe sharing her diary or something. These were her innermost thoughts and dreams. I couldn't help but push her towards them. And the quicker I thought, the better. No time to chicken out. Like that first date.
After doing all the paperwork and scraping together as much as I could, I offered Maybelle $45,000 for her property. And she said, oh my, I've already had two offers for considerably more than that. She had thought we could come closer to those other offers, and she'd been sure she'd pick us over them, even if we came in a little under, simply because she liked us. But $45,000 was just too low. I am so sorry. I thought you guys were going to be a little closer, she said. I am so sorry if I offended you, Maybelle. That's just what I have, I said. Well, if you could come up with a little more, call me, she replied. If not, I'm going to have to move on with those other people. I knew we couldn't come up with more. Putting together the financing on that $45,000 was a stretch as it was. That was that. I was really sad about it, of course. I'd managed to get all excited, imagining the possibilities for what I could do with it in that location. I'd envisioned that shop from top to bottom. I swear I could smell the candles burning inside and see the looks on my customers' faces when they found that perfectly unique item that would fit in that perfect spot in their home. I wasn't ready to give up. I knew we could probably find another location somewhere, but it was very hard to let go of the store I'd envisioned in that quirky old building on Bosque. So that night, and just about every night after that, I prayed, Lord, that's the building that spoke to me, and if it's meant to be, please make it come back around. 5. Opening up. Sometimes the thing we're dreaming of doesn't work out, but Chip and I weren't going to give up on the idea of opening my shop just because the building I fell in love with seemed to slip through our fingers. So we kept on looking for other buildings. We searched and searched, but nothing we found had the character or the charm of that little spot on Bosque. I was starting to lose hope when a few weeks into our renewed search, my prayers were suddenly answered. Maybelle called me on my cell phone. "Joanna, I've been praying about it, and I do not know why, but I feel very strongly that God is saying I need to sell this building to you for $45,000. I could hardly believe it. God made it so evident this was meant to be. I was about to open my very own business. Some friends and family members tried to talk me out of doing this. They felt it was just too big of a risk to take because I had no experience running a business of my own, no training in retail sales or marketing. I had never owned property before, and I knew next to nothing about home decor or design. Truly, the only home decorating I'd ever done was in the house where we currently were living, and that had just been one big experiment for me. But Chip did what Chip does and made all those facts, all that logic, seem irrelevant. He really did. He believed I could do it, and he was confident that what I didn't know, I could learn. I think part of what originally drew me to TV journalism was that I was a curious observer of other people. I may have been the quiet girl, but I was always the one who watched how things worked and took everything in. I told Chip all about how things worked in those shops in New York. Time spent by shoppers in those little boutiques was a sensory experience, and the store owners made sure of it. Women, especially, notice these kinds of details. The sweet smell of a candle burning, the color of a fresh bouquet of flowers next to the register, the music softly playing in the background, the allure of an interesting display. All of those things I'd mentioned earlier. As a shopper and a careful observer, I was able to appreciate the creative process that went into each little table and window installation. In that sense, I wanted to create a store that was an experience, not just a collection of things for people to buy. I wanted to design it with intention and be sure I set things up to catch the eye of my shoppers. I also wanted to make sure my displays were practical and inspired my visitors to know that they, too, could set up their homes like this. My goal was to make design relatable, to make it attainable. We took some time renovating that little house-like shop while I finished up our remodeling at home, and in the process, I started collecting inventory. I bought inexpensive merchandise at the Dallas Market Center, an incredible wholesale marketplace filled with items sourced from all over the world. I hit garage sales and flea markets, too, and found old mirrors and furniture and knickknacks that I could fix up or distress to make them more appealing while adding some value to them. At one point, I found a large brown wicker sleigh for $5. I couldn't believe how cheap it was. I thought to myself, if I could dress this thing up a bit, I could sell it for $25. Off to the local craft store I went. I found a fake ivy garland to wrap all around the sleigh and some battery-operated Christmas lights that I tucked into the ivy. I was so proud of the way it turned out that I thought maybe I could sell it before the shop even opened and get a taste for how this would all work. So I talked my father into putting it in his waiting area at Firestone with a price tag on it. But a week went by and I noticed the sleigh was still there. The second week, I called my dad. "Yes, Jojo, it's still here, but don't worry, it will sell." The third week went by and I told my dad that if it didn't sell, I would just come pick it up and get it out of the way. At that point, I felt deflated. I questioned more than ever if running a store was what I was supposed to be doing. But I went in toward the end of that third week, and my father handed me an envelope with $25 in it. "I told you you would sell it," he said. "Now go buy something for $20 and see if you can sell it for $50. This is how retail works, Jojo." Selling that sleigh made me feel like I could do this design thing despite the odds and my lack of experience. But the more I shopped for bargains that I could turn around for profit, the harder it was to choose between what I wanted to sell and what I wanted to use to finish turning our house into a home over on 3rd Street. It took nearly 8 months to get it to the point where that yellow house finally felt finished. I was so happy to be done and to be free of the dust and debris and tools everywhere and to finally get the place neatened up and livable. I don't like a lot of clutter. I like a clean house. If my house is too messy, I just can't think straight. And remodeling a house is messy by definition. So nearly 8 months after being carried into a house full of rotten meat and dog urine, I was thrilled to finally have a place where we could be comfortable. I was proud of what we'd done too. I hoped we'd live there for a long time, and I was ready to focus all of my energies on the shop. Then Chip came home one afternoon and said, "Hey, Joe, I bought a new house." "Oh," I said, "to rent out?" Well, eventually, yeah. We're going to be able to rent this house out now because we fixed it up. It's ready to go. So let's move down to this next house a few doors down and we'll fix that one up too. As nice as we made this one. We'll be able to make better rent on everything if we make all of them look this good. As I rode down the street with him to see what he'd bought, I was in shock when he pulled up in front of this tiny white box of a house. I mean tiny. Maybe 800 square feet. There was no cute front porch. The yard, front and back, was all weeds and overgrown bushes. When he opened the front door of that cabin-sized house, I could see it hadn't been touched in 30 years.
And she cried. Again. That was sort of her thing during year one. If we ever write a marriage book, I think chapter one will be called She Cried.
Chip assured me this was the right thing to do. This was how we were going to get ahead and make real money. He tried to remind me of the fun I'd had fixing up the yellow house, and I had to admit that some parts of it had been fun. I'd love coming up with the themes for the rooms and picking out all the colors and textures and learning how to do the work myself. But the yellow house wasn't just some house to me after doing all that work. It was my house. It was our home. But Chip never saw it like that. He really never got attached to anything that didn't have a heartbeat. These houses, they were just inventory to him. He liked messing with them, but he certainly didn't want to live in any one of them forever. Even though he didn't understand why I was so upset, he was smart enough to just leave me alone for a little while. I went back home and sat on the porch and thought, how can we just rent this house out to college kids? My house. We'd only been in there 8 months. Then I got to thinking about how much work it had been, and the idea of starting from scratch again seemed daunting, especially with everything I was trying to get done to the shop so it could open up. I cried it out until I reached a point where I realized there was nothing much I could do about it. He's already bought it, so we're kind of in this now. No one's going to rent that little white house in the condition it's in. One thing I learned there on that beautiful front porch was if I wanted to be successful, if I wanted to do important work one day, I would have to increase my capacity. I had to learn to manage disappointment. I needed to learn how to make the most out of these opportunities Chip seemed to keep finding. So I told Chip, okay. We rented our house out that very week to some college students and moved ourselves down the block. We started renovating again. And because this house was half the size and I was already actively out there looking for inventory for the shop, it didn't take nearly as long to get everything finished. We did suffer a few setbacks, like the time Chip decided to surprise me by using maroon grout on the white tile in the kitchen. He could tell I didn't like it the moment I walked into the room, and he wound up ripping it all out and doing it all over again. I'm not sure why I had such clear ideas about what I liked and I didn't like, but I did. And the funny thing is that after a couple of months, once I put my stamp on it, I was as much in love with that little house as I had been with the yellow one.
She still jokes to this day that I like that house because I could vacuum the whole place without ever unplugging the cord.
I could plug into one outlet and vacuum every room. I love that. It's true. Back at my shop, the one thing I was having a hard time designing was a sign for the front of the building. Chip and I had decided together that a little shop would be named Magnolia. I've always loved magnolia trees and their blooms. There's something so beautiful about a magnolia blossom. It demands attention, and you can't help but love those big, creamy petals and that fragrant smell. We'd handed out magnolia leaves at our wedding, and we'd had those two beautiful magnolia trees in the front of our first home together, so magnolias have always seemed like a part of us. Plus, they just seemed so entirely Southern. They reminded me of drinking sweet tea on the big wraparound porch of a 19th century plantation home or something. The name Magnolia just fit my business and the feeling I wanted to create. We loved it, but I really struggled with how to put the name on that sign. I figured I would have to hand-paint the thing since I didn't have a budget to have anything professionally made, and I just couldn't come up with anything that worked. I kept drawing things out, trying to write the word magnolia in different ways, using the flower itself in a logo of sorts, and it just never felt right to me. Then one day, Chip showed up with the back of his pickup truck, just loaded with old metal letters he'd found at a flea market. Big, oddly shaped letters taken from various old signs. They were mismatched and rusty and dented, and I loved them. We tacked them up on the front of the shop, spelling out the name that would come to mean so much, Magnolia. The letters were uneven and looked a little handmade and ragged, but it seemed to work. I loved the sign because Chip designed it and made it with his own two hands. It came together in such an imperfectly perfect way, and I hoped people would get it.
To this day, that sign is one of my proudest accomplishments. I mean, I'm no Joanna Gaines, but I certainly see things a little bit differently and love design in my own way. The first sign really reflected that for me. I would glow when I would hear a customer come in the shop and say, I saw the sign and just had to stop in.
Finally, in October of 2005, the shop was ready to go. In a rush, I hand-painted a dinky little open sign, but I ran out of space for the inn, so it dropped down at the end. It was just bad. I didn't have an advertising budget, and I hadn't done anything in marketing at all. We told plenty of people we knew, of course, and our parents had spread the word, but I was basically hoping that people would see my store when they were driving by and drop in. And yet I put out a sign on my opening day that looked like a 4-year-old had drawn it. It was pretty pathetic. Inside, the shop was pretty much everything I wanted it to be. In addition to the home decor items, I had a section full of fresh flowers for sale. They smelled so good and looked perfect. When I was in New York, I had lived next to a flower shop, and I'd love watching people walk out with fresh flowers wrapped in craft paper. I wanted to create that same feel in Waco, Texas that I experienced in New York City. So I had the flowers all ready to go, I had the candles burning, I had Frank Sinatra music playing, and at 9:55 a.m., just 5 minutes before the doors open, I started to freak out.
She was hyperventilating. I mean, no joke. I thought I was going to have to take her to the emergency room or something. She was so nervous.
I just started panicking. No one's going to come. Why is no one here? Chip and I had done the math. I needed to make at least $200 a day in order to pay the mortgage and insurance and electricity. That was $200 every day we were open just to stay afloat, without any profits. I'd been working so hard getting everything ready that I hadn't stopped to think about what might happen if the store didn't make that much money. I was close to a complete nervous breakdown thinking, what if this doesn't work?
Then, just after 10 o'clock, a Hummer pulled into the parking lot, followed by this beautiful Mercedes, followed by a Suburban, and then a BMW. All these rich women showed up out of nowhere.
They were doctors and lawyers' wives, stay-at-home moms and grandmothers who loved to shop and who did their best to make their homes feel nice. It turned out they'd all been watching my little shop come together during the renovations. They'd been eagerly anticipating my opening day for weeks, and it seemed that my idea of bringing a New York-style boutique experience to a home decor store wasn't far-fetched at all. There were a lot of people in town who were excited for it. My first day we opened, we made $2,800. By the way, my dad decided to sell his Firestone shop shortly after this. I went over and helped him clean out the attic one day, and guess what I found up there? The wicker sleigh that I'd fixed up nice with the garland and Christmas lights that I put up for sale in his lobby, it was still tucked in a corner. I just shook my head. He bought it himself to give me a little boost of confidence as I got ready to open my store. What can I say? It worked, and so did the shop. Sometimes when something is meant to be, it's meant to be. It had nothing to do with how I advertise, and it certainly didn't have anything to do with my being some kind of an amazing designer or having a reputation, because I wasn't any kind of designer at all, and no one knew who I was. I just knew what I liked, and I trusted that other people might like it too. And I was where I was supposed to be. I'd listened to my own intuition and let God guide me toward the plans He'd had for me all along. I mean, is there anyone who could possibly imagine that the way to get your life's calling would be to marry a guy who showed up an hour and a half late to your first date, and then to let that man talk you into opening your own small business in the first year of marriage? But guess what? It all seemed to be working out in the perfectly messy way life works when you trust in God and His plans for your life rather than focusing on your own. At that point, I wasn't anywhere near used to the dynamics of it all. Chip's impulsive buying of properties, the way I'd hate them at first and then come to love them, only to have to move out again, the unexpected twists and turns and the hardships we'd have to overcome to get ourselves back on course, all of that was still new to me. And as we repeated them over the next few years, moving from flip house to flip house and starting over again and again, there would be a whole lot of tears. But the fact that we established that crazy pattern of doing things in our own unique way so early on in our marriage was important. It prepared us for everything that would come later on. And Chip's decision to move us into that little white 800-square-foot house worked out exactly the way he said it would. It helped us get ahead and start making some sustainable income.
One of the real pluses to that second house was that it had this big side yard, and we could subdivide it, and we could build a whole second house to rent or sell right next to the one that we were living in. I bought that house, lot included, for $30,000, and we probably put about $25,000 into it. So we were all in for $55,000 on that little house, and it turned out to be beautiful. It really did. And we were able to build a brand new house next door for about $130,000. And of course, this was all debt. We didn't own anything outright. And getting the money to do all this hadn't come easy. The banks hadn't wanted to mess around with these little houses at first. They were either small potatoes, or the banks felt like I needed to build a reputation first. The few they actually had agreed to caused us to go scrambling every month just to make the payments and pay our own bills.
When it came to remodeling, we never took out any walls or did any major construction at that point. Everything was just cosmetic, but we tried to do things creatively and nice. We updated the kitchen with new appliances, and we'd use the existing cabinets and learn how to repaint them. We put in new countertops and a new backsplash when we could. We restored the hardwood floors, and I mean lots of them. Chip literally became an expert in setting tile and wood floor restoration. We took out the bathtub and replaced it with a nice wide shower with multiple shower heads and some body jets. Honestly, it felt luxurious, like the kind of shower you'd find in a really upscale house or a spa somewhere. Then came the paint, and we were done. And by that point, as I've mentioned, I would be in love with the place. But it wasn't just the work we put in that made me love that tiny white house. It wasn't even the easy vacuuming, though it was a plus. What made that house special was the incredible memories we made there. We threw Chip's 30th birthday party in that house's little backyard. I strung Christmas lights on the trees, and Chip built a fire pit that was unbelievable. We didn't have much in the way of backyard furniture, so I put hay bales all around the perimeter for people to sit on. There was a little old weathered shed in the back, and I lit that up too.
It looked like something you'd see in a magazine. It was one of the best parties I'd ever seen in my life. It was funny because we were basically poor. We didn't know how we were going to pay our bills from month to month. And we were living in this tiny little house, and I'd gone and invited all these college buddies to this party who had gone off and started making real money. They came in from Dallas and Austin and parked their Beamers and their Range Rovers up in the lawn of this tiny little $30,000 property we owned.
But we were proud of that house. We didn't think anything of it, and we were excited to have all of our friends from college there to see what we'd been up to and to celebrate Chip's 30th birthday together.
I was 30 years old and still living by the seat of my pants. I probably should have had my life together a little bit more by this point. But the thing was, my friends all had these stressed-out lives, and they came to our place, and it felt like we were just living this laid-back, beautiful, no-stress life. We made being poor look a lot of fun. All these corporate friends of ours were thinking, well, maybe it wouldn't have been that bad to stay in Waco after all. It wasn't just my friends that made that party special, though. My grandma was still alive at that time, and she came to that party, too. She was just the sweetest lady in the world. She had single-handedly raised my dad and his brother. And though she had a very tough life, you would have never known it by her attitude. Between my mom and my grandma, I was definitely genetically built for a positive optimism. That day with her was one of my fondest memories because she and I hung out on these bales of hay out behind this house for hours. It wasn't but a couple of years after that that she went to be with Jesus.
We made all kinds of big memories in that tiny house, and we were just getting started. The fact that we had some profits starting to roll in from my little shop on Bosque only added to the sense of security we were building. It's hard to describe the feeling that comes with starting your own business. It really is so much work in the beginning that you lose yourself in it. You lose your sense of time, and you can't believe how quickly the days go by because there's no time to focus on much of anything else. But then you open the doors, and it's like you've given birth to this new thing that didn't exist before. Then when it starts to flourish, well, that's just icing on the cake. To get to see it live and breathe and to know that this thing you've created out of thin air can put a smile on other people's faces is such a blessing. There was some woman who would come into that store and drop $1,500 in a single visit. It was unbelievable. But I think one of my favorite customers I had in that first year of Magnolia was a woman who didn't ever buy a thing. She would just show up now and then and poke around. And she told me one time, "I just come here because I want to be in here. This place inspires me." That was just about the greatest compliment I could ever imagine. She affirmed for me that I had accomplished exactly what I'd set out to do, and that made me even more passionate about creating an experience for my customers. I worked every day to come up with new touches that would make the experience memorable. I never got too comfortable with any particular look or design. I wanted to constantly challenge myself and make it better. If people were going to go out of their way to come into my store, I wanted to make sure it was worthwhile, whether they bought something or not. Magnolia was my baby, no doubt about that, but it wasn't long before I found out it wasn't the only baby I was going to have. 6. White picket fences. I've been asked from time to time how Chip and I managed to juggle all the things we did, and still do. I honestly don't have a good answer for that, other than to go back to the notion that we seem to energize one another when we're together. Although one explanation for where we find a little extra time in our days is the fact that since we got married, we've never had a TV in our own house.
That's one of the questions I always field on Twitter. Hey man, why didn't Joe ever set up a TV in any of these homes? I think they're implying I maybe need to turn in my man card, but this is actually the answer to that question.
Before we got married, the two of us attended a few premarital counseling sessions with Chip's friend and one of his mentors, Byron Weathersby, and his wife, Carla. Byron had played a significant part in Chip's life as a college student, and since then, Chip sought Byron's wisdom on lots of things. Chip and I felt that applying that same logic to our marriage, getting advice from these two trusted and seasoned marriage pros, couldn't be a bad thing. We wanted to start a habit of seeking outside opinions just to make sure that we were thinking about everything a new couple ought to think about as we started our new life together. One of the things Byron and Carla suggested was that we try to stay focused on each other and spend quality time doing things we love together, especially when we were at home. That seemed like a no-brainer to us, but they explained that being in the same house and actually interacting with each other are two different things. Sometimes it's easy for couples to get lost in their own little worlds at home, to be so focused on other things that they aren't really together, even though they're in the same room. To counter that tendency, Byron and Carla suggested we try to go the first few weeks of our marriage without a TV. The idea was to find other ways to occupy our time, especially in the evenings, with the activities that we could truly share. It seemed like reasonable advice, and so we tried it. Well, 6 months later, neither one of us had the slightest urge to get a TV. We'd never even found time to miss it. All our various projects kept us busy during the day, and our evenings were pretty filled up with making dinner and finishing up the day's business, talking and dreaming together, and making plans for the next day or the next week. We couldn't imagine setting aside even an hour to sit and watch TV. That's not to say we never slowed down. Reading a good book, flipping through magazines, learning new card games together, taking walks together, we found a million ways to enjoy some downtime.
Now, to be fair, we've caught our fair share of TV at friends' houses or our parents' home. Anytime there was a big game or a fun show, we would find a way to catch it. It was at a restaurant, maybe a date we would take at a friend's house. So we managed to catch up on some of our favorite shows through these outlets.
We've had more than 13 years now without a TV, and I don't feel we've missed a thing. Just when we thought our lives couldn't get any busier, just as we'd settled into that little white house and my store was getting off the ground, I received the wonderful news that I was pregnant with our first child. Just the thought of having a baby filled me with all sorts of new inspiration, not the least of which was imagining the room I wanted my baby to come home to. The tiny second bedroom in that 800-square-foot house needed a complete makeover to turn it into a nursery, and thinking about that actually spurred an idea that gave me a new perspective on decorating. I had made the decor in our second home more cohesive than the ones in the yellow house. The colors were continuous, and the rooms all tied together, rather than each space having its own theme. My store was so busy that I kept finding new furnishings and swapping them in and out between the store and our home, and I felt like I was starting to get a hang of this thing called decorating. Once I found out I was having a boy, I zeroed in on the earthy tones and a sort of outside meets inside theme in the room. Instead of the standard baby blue, I wanted something warm and comfortable that would reflect the rest of that luxurious little retreat we'd created. But I didn't have a lot of money to spend on that little nursery. Any money we made seemed to go right into another project or investment or just keep up the payments on all the loans we'd taken out. I realized we just couldn't afford any extra bells and whistles on that room, not even window treatments. I knew that window treatments can be expensive, but I decided to look at our tiny budget as a design challenge. I stood in the nearly finished nursery one day, just staring out the window, and I noticed the little white picket fence we'd put up in the front yard. An idea popped into my head immediately. Hey, Chip, what would happen if you went and got some pieces of picket fence at the lumberyard and built an awning out of that wood for the inside of this nursery? I sketched it out for him with the picket fence coming down at an angle from all the windows, kind of like an awning you'd see on the outside of a restaurant. Chip ran with it and figured out how to tack fencing to another board so we could hang it just so. We painted it, and it worked. I stood back when we were done, looked at the room, and realized something big. Having a tight budget doesn't have to mean watering down the design. If anything, it forced me to get more creative, and there was so much joy in that for me. I love that awning Chip built way more than I ever would have loved a store-bought window treatment. It turned out perfect and taught me one of my fundamental design rules. Don't be afraid to think outside the box.
People like those awnings so much that we actually started building them and selling them to our clients. For a season, those things were hot.
Well, that was the other thing that had happened. Beyond the house flipping and rental properties, we started picking up clients for remodels and redesigns. As my baby bump grew behind the counter at the store, I found that more and more of those moms and grandmothers who came in to browse started bringing me pictures of rooms in their homes and asking me for my advice. I just don't like this room, and I don't know why, they would say. I would look at those pictures and suggest that maybe they could switch the furniture around or put up something interesting on a wall that had nothing but flat picture frames on it. I would recommend changing the wall color or adding a nice lamp in a nook or adding new throw pillows for a pop of color on the sofa. It was a new challenge daily, but giving the advice sharpened my design skills, and I learned a few things about my own style in the process. It was an education for me. But more than that, it started to evolve into a second business. Occasionally, I'd point out that a room called for much more than just new throw pillows, and then the owner would ask, "Well, is this something you could do for me? I'd love to just hire you and Chip to come in and do the work." Between building the new house on our newly subdivided lot, continuing work on some small flip homes, and managing the rentals, Chip had more work than he could do himself, so he'd put a crew of workmen together. The boys, as we called them, were a talented bunch of hard-working guys who were just as adaptable as Chip seemed to be when it came to making my crazy ideas become reality. I truly could say, "Hey, why don't we have that tree out of the front yard and hang it upside down in the master bedroom?" And they would do it, no questions asked. All right, maybe there'd be a little head-scratching, but then they'd shrug their shoulders and get to work. So between all of us, we'd pick up this occasional additional work doing interiors, painting, refinishing floors, basically redecorating for these new clients. It wasn't easy to juggle it all, especially since I was running the store by myself for that first year, but I loved every minute of it. There was no doubt in my mind that I was doing what I was meant to be doing. I wonder sometimes if we know ourselves a lot better than we think we do when we're children. We get into our teen years and college years, and so many of us let others redefine who we are, or we get lost along the way and have no idea what we really want to do with our lives. But once we finally figure it out, it often seems easy to look back into our childhoods and find a few clues that say, "Hey, maybe you were heading that direction all along." For me, the entrepreneurial spirit was always there. During my young years in Wichita, Kansas, my mom worked at a little gift shop owned by one of her friends. After school, my two sisters and I would go there while she worked, and I would always play store. I would sit there and pretend that I was working the cash register. I would have my sisters bring stuff up to the counter, and I would wrap it up. I loved doing that. Even when we'd get home, I would set up my whole room like a store and then have fake customers come in. At one point, I had a set of Lee press-on nails, and I would make my sisters come in like customers to a spa. I was always thinking about ways to make money, so I would basically make my sisters pay me for whatever they were buying, even if it was only a dime. On the weekends, I made a habit of setting up these makeshift little carnivals in our backyard and charging neighborhood kids a dollar to get in. I'd have lemonade and rides, primarily just the swing set, and games. To swing on the swing set would cost you another dime, but I always wanted it to be this fun experience for everyone, so I'd work hard all week getting it set up. My sisters basically provided free labor for me, in addition to having to pay to get in. I'm not sure why they went along with it, seeing that I was the middle child, but they did. Home was the place where I asserted myself, and I wasn't shy about it the way I was in other places. I felt safe at home, and I felt like I could be me. I was also a creative kid, but not in terms of artistry or design or anything like that. I was just always pretending. I kept trying to invent wings so I could fly, or I would always try to come up with something that someone would buy. So I was always thinking. I remember playing a lot by myself. My older sister and my younger sister, when they weren't being my minions, were usually out playing with the neighborhood kids, but I could usually be found in a corner playing make-believe. I pretended different things at different phases of my childhood. For a while, I was always doing pretend commercials. So if I were eating breakfast, I would hold up the cereal box and say, "Kellogg's, we make this nutritious." I would read it like a newscaster and pretend that I was on a commercial. Sometimes I'd do the same thing with a bottle of shampoo in the shower. No matter where I was, I would act out these commercials as if I had a real audience. That's another strange thing, considering what I'm doing now. Growing up, I sometimes felt like this audience of mine was always with me, watching me in my pretend store, watching me do some commercials. It was almost as if I was living in The Truman Show, that movie with Jim Carrey in which a character is filmed from the moment of birth and watched by millions as he goes through his daily life. Even if I was all by myself, I would look around and think, "I know you're out there watching me." My parents remember hearing me talking to this unseen audience often when I was a little girl. They say I always swore I had a pet rabbit named Joe, but according to my parents, it was just make-believe. It was all the expression of a creative mind. Anyway, looking back, I can see there were a whole bunch of things in my childhood that pointed toward what I'd do in my adult life. And once I started doing it for real, I thrived. It seemed that the more opportunities I had to get creative and get entrepreneurial, the more fulfilled and energized I felt about life. Outside of the store, Chip and I kept most of our endeavors in our typical wheelhouse. We sank our money and time into Third Street, where Chip continued to be the honorary mayor as he continued to expand his rental and home building business. A big part of Chip's dream for that street began in a deal he made before we were married. Chip and his father went in on a deal together to purchase 11 acres of land just a few blocks from where we would live as newlyweds. Chip was convinced that the Third Street area would go up in value. Baylor University was only about a mile away, just across LaSalle Avenue. And eventually, Chip believed that Baylor would run out of room to house its growing student population. Well, his intuition on that was right. A big out-of-town company came along and saw what Chip was doing with his few small rental houses in this mostly untouched area of Waco, and they made him an offer. A good offer on those 11 acres. Their plan was to build hundreds of units of dorm-style apartment homes on 3rd Street to market to the Baylor community. They were basically going to create a whole new neighborhood on the land Chip and his dad had been sitting on. Chip wasn't interested in selling all of the land off. He had big dreams of owning rental homes up and down 3rd Street, so he structured a deal that sold off the back part of the acreage to that big company, while he kept the acreage along the road frontage to split into small lots.